Much has been said, here included, about the plans to export natural gas from a planned terminal at Jordan Cove on the Oregon coast near North Bend. The terminal plan includes a more than 200-mile pipeline that would run from the Klamath Basin to the coast, and Jordan Cove is not one of a kind. Other plans for fossil fuel export terminals are on the drawing board in Oregon and Washington. 9 in total are included in the report from the Sightline Institute. Let's hear more about the Institute and the report. Eric DePlace is the policy director at Sightline Institute and the lead author of the report called Fracked Fuel and Petrochemical Proposals in the Northwest. Eric, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you for having me on this morning. I appreciate it.
Great. It's good to have you. Would you first give us an idea what the Sightline Institute is all about?
Sure. We are the sustainability think tank for the Pacific Northwest. We're headquartered in Seattle, Washington, but we work in Oregon, British Columbia, and, of course, Washington, on a range of issues connected to sustainability, so economic issues, environmental issues, and a bunch of others.
Okay, I was going to ask you, so it's a very broad focus on sustainability, it sounds like.
It is, yes. My particular slice of the pie is looking at energy transport questions, energy policy, climate policy, and things like that, and that's what brought my attention to this particular set of issues.
You describe this as a third wave of energy transport proposals. What were the first two?
Yeah, so that's a great way to start this conversation. And, you know, if we go back to, let's say, 2010, 2011, what we would see at that time is that the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest, which was historically, you know, a backwater for the energy industry, not a major center of development, suddenly was confronted with a huge range of coal export proposals. That was the first wave. And so we had 6 proposals for coal export terminals in Oregon and Washington, plus another 4 in British Columbia. The second wave was a whole range of proposals to move oil by rail. Most of those concentrated in Washington, some on the Columbia River, and we've seen some in the Bay Area and further south in California as well. But the Northwest ended up being this real epicenter for projects, and it's still being contested quite seriously whether or not to move large-scale oil by rail. The third wave is actually this kind of amorphous category of fracked fuels and petrochemicals. Now, the Jordan Cove proposal that you mentioned has been around for a little bit longer, but many of these proposals are brand new. And what they're doing is they're taking these light fracked fuels and then figuring out some way to move them to the coast, process them in some ways, and then export them to markets in the Pacific Rim.
Well, since you mentioned markets, why don't we go for the economic part of this first? I have to believe that given the general range of prices that can be obtained for fuels at the moment, that these aren't particularly economical. They probably don't pencil out at this very moment in time.
Well, it sort of depends on how you look at it. I mean, for a lot of these folks, you know, if you're certainly if you're an oil producer, you know, oil prices are down so far that it's difficult to figure out how the math works out to put any money in your pocket. On the other hand, if you are, let's say, the government of China, and you're looking to acquire low-cost methanol derived from natural gas, you would look at, you know, $16 in East Asia and, you know, $2.50 in the American West. And so there, because there's a big price differential between some of these locations, there can be a strong economic incentive for purchases in foreign markets to look to the U.S. or North American West to try to obtain some of these fuels at cost.
Oops, my mistake. I was thinking the sellers, and in fact, it's a much more attractive deal for the buyers.
In many cases, that's right. So, for, you know, again, like I said, for oil producers in the U.S. and Canada, it's not much of a going concern right at this particular moment, although prices are notorious for, you know, changing pretty drastically. But we have seen, and the reason I gave the example from China is we have seen, you know, multi-billion dollar projects financed and backed by the Chinese government to do exactly what I said, which is to take large quantities of natural gas out of the Canadian Rockies, process that into methanol, which is a petrochemical, and then export that to China. And the reason for that, despite what they say, is mostly just the economic differential between the cost of gas in the North American West as opposed to Asia.
Eric DePlace is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, policy director of the Sightline Institute and the lead author of a report called Fracked Fuel and Petrochemical Proposals in the Northwest, which looks at a series of proposals, including the Jordan Cove project planned for the Coos Bay area to take petrochemicals and fracked fuels off our coast and send them elsewhere. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments at 800-838-3760. And our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I said 9 when I was starting off. It's actually 8 different proposals here, I see.
Yes, 8 in Oregon and Washington that I was able to count. You know, these numbers have a way of changing. Sometimes they go up and occasionally they go down. But, you know, they do span kind of an array of different types of projects, but all sort of observing this the same notion that we can get this cheap, these cheap light hydrocarbons out of the ground with fracking, and then, you know, various configurations of projects try to figure out how to process that stuff in a way to make it eligible for transport abroad.
I'm curious to know how much things might have changed over time. I know because we've seen some proposals, you know, rise and then seem to flutter away for lack of commitment or interest or something. But so is this list at eight somewhat shorter than it might have been a year ago?
Well, it's longer than it had been a year ago, actually. So, you know, I would say that coal export came up big a few years back, and most of those proposals have died off now. There are a couple of big ones remaining, both on the Columbia River and then north, you know, the Canadian border. The oil by rails, you know, seems to be a little bit earlier in that same trajectory. But this is the new stuff. This is what I think the next generation of energy projects will be like. And I actually suspect we'll see more of these in the future. And that's principally because it's so economical to get this stuff out of the ground now. You know, we've perfected fracking and horizontal drilling technologies such that we are able to, you know, just obtain massive quantities of light natural gas, propane-like products, you know, and so forth. Shale oil is another good example of that. The question then is how do you move it to the coast in an economical fashion, and then what do you do with it? And that's the reason, actually, why the Pacific Northwest has been right in the crosshairs of this stuff, is because when you look at sort of where the rail routes are, where the possible pipeline routes are and all that stuff, and our proximity to Asia, you know, the economical way to move this stuff, if you're going to move it, is going to be, you know, basically between Coos Bay and Prince Rupert, British Columbia, which is, you know, just south of the kind of the Alaska border on the North BC coast. And if it's not kind of in that little sliver of coast, it's going to be pretty hard to figure out how to make this stuff work economically.
In fact, that is a pretty short, by comparison to some other West Coast ports, distance to Asian ports.
That's absolutely right, yes. And that's one of the reasons, of course, why the Jordan Cove proposal at Coos Bay has been so robustly backed by the project developers, because it offers, you know, strong economic benefits from the perspective of transportation costs.
You mentioned that the earlier coal proposals, several of those had died off. I mean, was that due to the economics of coal? I mean, I've been watching as the coal industry seems to have declined precipitously in the last year or three, which has meant, you know, changes for other industries like the railroads, which are heavily dependent on moving coal out of the Powder River Basin, for example. So is that generally what's driving the reason for some of these proposals for coal export terminals falling by the wayside?
I would say it's one of two major factors. I mean, you're absolutely right that the wheels have come off the coal industry domestically. And, I mean, you know, companies that were absolute titans just a few years back are now, you know, talking to their bankruptcy lawyers. And, you know, we don't expect that industry is going to turn around probably ever, which is a good thing. You know, so the economics were certainly unfavorable for those projects. But, again, it's the big question is about the difference in prices that they can command, you know, in Asia as opposed to here. And we've seen what was happening back in 2011, 2012 was this real spike in commodity prices, including for coal. And so at the time, it looked like, well, their domestic markets are drying up, but if they can just get the stuff to the opposite side of the ocean, then no big deal, we'll be able to make a profit. That commodity boom went bust, and so as a consequence, now they don't have a paying proposition over there either. But the other factor that I think gets overlooked is how robust the citizen opposition movement was to all those projects. And so, you know, they came in expecting to get this stuff built and operated within 6 months or a year, and what happened was they just ran into a buzzsaw of opposition from local opponents everywhere, from, you know, Coos Bay to Bellingham. And that, you know, created delay and headache. It created political pressures on them. It messed up their financing. And so what happened is this hornet's nest just erupted on them in the Northwest. And I think that's as big a part, if not a bigger part of the story, than the actual finances.
Will that? I mean, it seems like it'll continue to be a story with the facilities that you, the planned facilities listed here, because at Jordan Cove in particular, we've watched this has been just an ongoing onslaught of people concerned about the proposal.
Right, and you know, and I think one of the things that's interesting about the Northwest is that, I mean, these projects are riddled with flaws. They're riddled with risks. They create all kinds of hazards, including economic hazards as well as the environmental ones. In the Northwest, it is possible to get those issues surfaced. It's possible to create a broad citizens or grassroots movement around them, and you know, develop a serious public conversation about whether, you know, it's wise to move forward with these proposals. I think what we've seen with the Jordan Cove project is a lot of those issues have risen up to the surface, and you know, the more people talk about them and debate them, the the more skeptical people get about, well, what is in it for us if we build, you know, this huge pipeline and we build this big LNG facility. I mean, yeah, we get some jobs. Yeah, there's some capital investment, but you know, when you kind of weigh the whole thing in the scales, it looks like a less and less, you know, valuable proposition for the region. And so, but we've seen this debate play out over and over again with projects like this. And I think the Jordan Cove is an excellent example of how that works.
Eric DePlace is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the policy director at the Sightline Institute, a think tank. And he is also the lead author of a report from the Sightline Institute called Fracked Fuel and Petrochemical Proposals in the Northwest, which outlines places like the Jordan Cove gas export terminal that are on the drawing board for Oregon and Washington, 8 in all, in a couple of different realms. You can join us on the exchange. Your questions, your comments are welcome as you think about petrochemicals and their movement through the Northwest. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. When I think about supply and demand, though, which is really what drives the economics of anybody wanting to build terminals like these, Jordan Cove in particular has been a hinge that swung both ways. It was originally an import terminal, but then when the fracking boom took place and we suddenly had a glut of petrochemicals onshore, it became an export terminal, which raises the question, is if everything is decided by supply and demand, how confident are the suppliers of petrochemicals to these potential export facilities confident that those supplies will last a while?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I mean, you know, I've always said that if you're going to get into the gambling business, you should get in on the opposite side of energy forecasters because they're just wrong all the time. And you know what I mean by that is that, you know, if you look back 5-10 years and think about the way that people were talking about energy supplies and natural gas is a great example of this, or price forecasting. They're always supremely confident in their predictions, but they have turned out to be wrong over and over again. And often just, you know, the what's happened is diametrically opposed to what, you know, the consensus view was. So as you said, you know, there was a time when we were thinking about, in this country, importing large quantities of natural gas. Now, as you said, the fracking boom took off. Now we're swimming in light hydrocarbons like natural gas. And so then the question is, well, how fast can we export it somewhere else? You know, and actually, I would say the fracking boom is one of the things that undercut the coal industry. I mean, it was the fact that we were, you know, swimming in low-cost natural gas that knocked the legs out from under domestic coal producers who were using that coal for power plants. So, you know, all this stuff kind of gets mixed into the same picture. What's going to happen down the road? You know, I think it's anybody's guess. I mean, one of the things that hasn't happened yet is we haven't seen China and some of the big East Asian economies, which have huge supplies of natural gas and shale oil, they haven't really started fracking yet. When and if they start doing that, then they're going to be well supplied with extremely cheap gas as well. And then what's the economic argument for export? Probably not much. And so you could end up with a situation where you build all this hard infrastructure that's super disruptive, you sink all this money in, and the markets dry up just as you hit completion. I think that's a very serious risk. You know, leaving aside the environmental questions, which are maybe the bigger ones, but just on the economics, I think there are tons of risks about this stuff.
We have a question here from Derek and Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Eric DePlace from the Sightline Institute.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. With respect to the Jordan Cove project, I don't quite understand. I mean, it's an issue that blows up the partisan divide, and it's very bipartisan opposition to it. Why is the governor's office so reluctant to come out against it, given the bipartisan opposition to it? And then also, are you able to track the big money influence that a project like this brings? And specific to Jordan Cove, do you have ways of determining where that money is being flexed?
All right, good questions. Thanks for those, Derek.
Yeah. As for the governor's office, you know, I could only speculate. I have to say I am disappointed that the governor's office has not been more directly involved in a critical way, both the previous administration and this administration. You know, I think that's a real shame, and I think some of it has to do with the fact that Coos Bay is relatively far from the centers of power in Oregon. But, you know, certainly I would expect that with an opposition movement like this, you know, you do, once there's a parade moving, politicians usually try to scramble to get to the head of the parade and take credit for it, which can be a good thing. So, you know, my sense is that the louder that opposition movement gets, and again, it is a very bipartisan opposition movement, or at least it crosses the partisan divide, we would see the elected officials move in that direction as well. As for your question about tracking the money, I haven't looked at that project in particular. I think those exercises are very worth doing, and you often uncover some really interesting things about just which elected officials are taking money from these companies, because usually you will find you will find a nexus between the project backers and some of the folks who have who play an oversight role over them. So I think that's very worth doing. I haven't done it myself, but I would encourage folks to do it.
Interesting point you bring up about Coos County being rather far from the power centers of Oregon. But is it one of these cases with Jordan Cove, and I want to expand this to the other projects as well, whether the greatest support is right there next to where the project would be and therefore provide the most jobs, and it tends to get a lot less as you get farther away from it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, I guess. I mean, there are I actually don't like to think about these projects on a strictly local basis. I mean, it turns out that the opposition is always, and the support is always most intensely concentrated right near the physical footprint of the project. But the reason I wrote the report the way I did is that I think this stuff is ultimately regional. And if there's a way in which we could play whack-a-mole, and if Jordan Cove went down, maybe Oregon LNG up near Astoria would get built, or vice versa. And so what I think is important, and I think it's important in the opposition movement to these things, is to remember that we're all kind of connected to each other, whether we want to be or not. So I think it would be appropriate to surface regional-scale opposition arguments to these projects, because if you build a facility in Coos Bay, what that does is induce the construction of a massive pipeline through private property across sensitive lands. What it does is put these gas-carrying vessels onto the Pacific Ocean, and it's totally appropriate for us to think about that kind of larger-scale picture.
We're going to take a few more minutes and continue talking with Eric DePlace from the Sightline Institute, where he's the policy director. He's also the lead author of something, a report called Fracked Fuel and Petrochemical Proposals in the Northwest, which includes Jordan Cove, but several other facilities as well, planned facilities. You can join us at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Eric, are some of these alternates of one another? For example, if an LNG export terminal gets built in either Warrenton or North Bend, is the other one likely to go away?
It's a good question. I mean, there are folks who have made those sorts of claims, and I just sort of hinted at it a second ago. It's tough to know. I mean, in the case of those particular projects, the gas for Jordan Cove, I believe, is being supplied out of the hub at Malin, Oregon, so it's coming out of the U.S. Rockies by way of Southern Oregon, Northern California. The Oregon LNG project up near Astoria would be taking gas from Canada. There are, I think, in British Columbia, something shocking, like maybe 20 different projects for LNG facilities. Many of those are in competition with each other. They are all derived from the same, or would be derived from the same gas fields in Northeast BC, and those definitely are in competition. Whether Oregon LNG and Jordan Cove are in direct competition, I think, is less clear, even though I did sort of suggest that a second ago. There's some upper limit. I mean, there's some upper limit to how much gas we could possibly export economically or otherwise. We do have to be sensitive to that, those dynamics as well.
Okay, another call from Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Eric DePlace.
Thank you. I would like to speak up for the children of Jordan Cove. It'd be in a delightful oceanside community, and then find people who are going to take away your night sky. There's going to be lights on 24 hours a day, obscuring your vision of the stars. Every night you go to bed, you'll have a picture of Hiroshima in your mind, because if anything ever happens to that terminal, that town, those children are gone. And for you to impose this psychological burden on these children for the sake of a few wealthy mega oil exporters to bring virtually no benefit to us, the citizens of Oregon, I think is just shameful.
All right. Thanks for that, Grumpy John. Appreciate it. Have you looked at any of the specific safety issues with any of these individual things, or did you just look at them as a group and outline what was going on?
Well, you know, in this project, we tried to basically create a regional inventory so that we could, you know, begin to stitch together, you know, a picture of what the fabric looks like for the entire Pacific Northwest. There are extremely real safety concerns, human health and safety concerns at each of these project sites. I think the caller is absolutely right to point out that this does present a very direct and serious threat to, you know, whichever community gets built in this case, the North Bend, Coos Bay area. You know, in some cases, we have started to look at kind of the aggregate safety effects when you have multiple industrial sites co-located. One good example of that is actually Tacoma, Washington, where you've got a proposed LNG facility, much smaller than Jordan Cove, but still an LNG facility, right next to a big methanol refinery that's proposed, right next to two projects that are taking combustible oil trains. And so you can imagine where, you know, something goes wrong at one of those facilities, and the next thing is you've got a smoking crater on Puget Sound. And I think that sort of thing could play out in a similar way, at least in theory, in a place like Coos Bay.
In general, do you assess the chances of any of these places getting completed?
You know, right now, I think that there's a good chance we're going to play a complete shutdown defense in the Northwest. We have seen not one single project like this that's been opposed actually get built. What we have seen is a delay. We've seen costs driven up. I think that there's a decent chance, given the kind of nature of the opposition in the Northwest, that absolutely none of them get built. And that's frankly what I hope.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens there. Stephen in Eugene has a question that he sent in by email. He says, California has strong environmental protection laws like the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA, that apply to these types of projects, where Oregon has none other than federal law. Would Oregon be in a better position if we had a law like CEQA?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question about it that, you know, Oregon does not have some of the environmental review tools and oversight tools that you might get in other places. And I think that is a liability. And it's one of the reasons why we've seen certain kinds of projects targeted at Oregon, some of them on the south side of the Columbia River up near Clatskanie, for this exact reason, to avoid environmental review in Washington State. That being said, it's not the end of the story. You know, FERC is going to approve whatever pipeline they're presented with. That's the Federal Regulatory Agency for Pipelines. But there's a lot about Oregon that still allows them, the state, to stop this project.
All right. The entire list is LNG terminals proposed for Jordan Cove near Astoria and at Tacoma, LPG facility at Longview, Washington, methanol at the Port of Tacoma, at the Port of Kalama, and the Port of St. Helens, and then a xylene plant proposed for Anacortes, Washington, is the full list put out in this report, which is called Frack Fuel and Petrochemical Proposals in the Northwest. Eric DePlace is the lead author and the policy director at the Sightline Institute and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Take it easy.